the 1996 Sunstone Symposium presents session 224, The Garden in Eden, Genesis 2:4-4:2, by Lou W. Wallace and Michael P. Walton.
We'd like to welcome you to the next session, number 224. This is a paper entitled, quote, The Garden of Eden, end quote, by Dr. Lou Wallace. The story of the Garden of Eden, although very short, is filled with much meaning and instruction about God and our relationship with God, about good and evil, about man's relationship with woman, about man's relationship with the earth, and many things. It is a common link that binds the Judeo-Christian world together in understanding. What if we were wrong in our interpretation of some of its passages? How would a more correct understanding influence our beliefs? That is the subject that we're going to hear a discussion of today. Dr. Lou Wallace is a family physician who's been practicing in California. I believe he practiced for about 40 years. But he's here today as a scholar in Old Testament, and he asked me to emphasize the word amateur scholar. But by the end of this session, I think we may strike the word amateur. He has for a number of years devoted himself to a study of Old Testament, and he has done an analysis of various translations of the Garden of Eden story from Genesis, starting with chapter 2, verse 4, and he has relied upon a number of texts, a number of translations, I believe up to 6 different translations, to give us some insights into the meaning of the passages through different interpretations. He is married to Nola Wallace, who is a contributor to Sunstone, and I believe is participating in this symposium this year, as she has in the past. They have 4 children. Dr. Wallace has practiced in Alhambra, California, now lives in San Gabriel, California, and also has a home in Idaho. And we look forward to hearing his paper. We will then hear from Dr. Michael Walton, who has a PhD in history and science, is his field at the University of Chicago. Dr. Walton, when I asked him to give me a brief biographical sketch, he said that he publishes a lot. And I think that's going to be self-evident. His specialty is in biblical criticism, and particularly in history of the interrelationship between science and religion, particularly in the 15th and 16th centuries. So we look forward to his comments on Dr. Wallace's paper. Let me remind you that at the end of their presentations, it appears that we'll have some time for questions from what they tell me. And so we invite questions, encourage them, but we would ask that you come up to the microphone to ask them, because everything is being recorded. And if you don't feel inclined to come up, then we'll repeat the question for you into the microphone. I'm also asked to remind those of you who are in attendance that this session is by ticket. And if we have any interlopers who have not paid for their attendance here, they will be invited up to give comments and open confession in front of the group. So we will now hear from Dr. Lou Wallace.
Albert was hard up for genuine scholars, so he put up with me, an amateur scholar. First of all, preface to this Garden in Eden. For over 1,000 years now, thoughtful clergymen and scholars reading the Old Testament have on occasion expressed doubts about the traditional Moses authorship of the first 5 books, the Torah or Pentateuch. For the first 5 centuries, the few bold enough to do this were stripped of their office or priesthood and excommunicated or imprisoned, their books banned and burned. they'd found many things contained in the Torah that happened long after Moses was dead. For example, the list of the kings of Edom. Moses was strangely sometimes referred to in the third person. Terms were used that Moses would not have known, and places were described where Moses had never been. Moses, quote, spoke to the children across the Jordan, unquote, and quote, there was never another prophet in Israel like Moses, unquote. The language also reflected another time, a recurring phrase to this day, suggesting that the account was recorded much later. Another very confusing thing was the presence of doublets, two accounts of the same event, often with different or even contradictory details. We have two accounts of creation, two versions of the flood, two accounts of the Abrahamic covenant, two versions of the naming of Isaac, two accounts of Abraham passing Sarah as his sister, two versions of Jacob's journey to Mesopotamia, two accounts of the revelation to Jacob at Bethel, two of God changing Jacob's name to Israel, and so on. Most confusing of the doublets is the giving of the Ten Commandments, the Decalogue. It is impossible to produce a coherent story using all the information in Deuteronomy and Exodus about who went up the mountain and when and what was done there and who came down and when and with what and what they found after they descended. The accounts are impossibly mixed and contradictory. The generally accepted story is constructed from parts of the accounts, ignoring the discrepancies. There are even triplets, three versions of the same story. All these things implied multiple authors, or at least in the early accounts, two accounts, because, and I consider this most important, in one set of the accounts, deity is called JHWH, or Yahweh. The vowels for Adonai were put underneath those consonants, and we got the non-word Jehovah. So I will be, this is why I'll be calling it Yahweh. The other account, deity is always called El, or El Shaddai. Eventually, in the 18th century, a German minister, a French doctor, and a German professor began to assemble these pieces of evidence into a recognizable picture of the developmental history of the Pentateuch, a task that was finally accomplished by the German Julius Wellhausen. It's been long noted that the Book of Deuteronomy was very different in style and language and did not connect in any logical way to the other four books of the Pentateuch. This meant that there were at least five authors. One, the original J or Yahwist author. Two, the E or Elohist author. Three, the redactor R, who merged the two versions. Four, the D or Deuteronomy author. And five, the P or other priestly authors who accounted for the long sections of temple religious worship details in Numbers and Leviticus. When the sections attributed to the J author were separated out and translated, they revealed a brilliant piece of writing which Dr. Harold Bloom, Sterling Professor of the Humanities at Yale, declared was written by a woman. Dr. Bloom, author of some 20 books, including American Religion, has read and studied English literature as well as other religious books published by the churches, including the LDS. His reasons for thinking that J was a woman are in his book called The Book of J, which also includes a translation of the J material by David Rosenberg, poet and translator, formerly editor-in-chief of the Jewish Publication Society. Dr. Bloom felt that the writing was on par with that of Shakespeare, and was so skilled that not a single word was used without deliberation and intent. He says that she, the author, would probably have been a high member of King Solomon's court, writing shortly after his death in 933 BCE when the kingdom had split in two. This is an inference you get from some of the subtle disparagement of the king of Israel. This was some 300 years earlier than the account written by the E. Elohist author. The blending of the two stories probably occurred much later, after the priests of Israel had fled to Judah, to Jerusalem, to escape the 722 BCE Assyrian destruction of Samaria by Sargon II, and brought with them their version of Hebrew religious history. When all languages like Hebrew were finally reduced to writing, the written characters, first borrowed from Phoenician, were simply memory aids for reading aloud. Now this is a transliteration. It's my name transliterated into Japanese and written in the katakana. My name in Japanese, they have no L, so it's Warasu. This makes translation even more difficult. Different consonants and word spacing and different vowels can change meaning and content remarkably. The original readers almost had to know in advance what they were reading. Trying to illustrate this difficulty in English was so complex that I finally selected just seven consonants. With these seven consonants, depending on consonant separation, more than 90 legitimate common words can be formed simply by inserting different vowels. From these 90 words, 10 intelligible sentences can be constructed without word transposition. Two of them, of the three about God, are contradictory. Question, which is the correct translation? Language is our use of symbols to convey meaning and feeling, and is an inadequate tool at best. When these thoughts have to be translated into another language, the difficulties go up exponentially. Sometimes it's a case of you can't get there from here. There are simply no adequate equivalent words or phrases. Much cannot be translated due to differences in language structure. For example, grammar, tense, case, gender, and so forth. English has no personal speech. Latin has no definite article. You can't say the truth in Latin because there's no such word as the. English is gender specific with three genders, masculine, feminine, neuter, but we do not indicate them with suffixes. Hebrew has no neuter. Them is masculine, even if you're talking about two women. Poetry is virtually impossible to translate. The music and rhymes, the rhythms of the words in the two languages are never the same. Unfortunately, the Old Testament is two-thirds poetry. For poetry was used for communications, especially religious messages, laws, and information, that needed to be remembered. And you remember poetry better than you do prose, and then to be transmitted orally. Hebrew was an oral language until after 1000 BCE, when they borrowed the newly invented Phoenician characters and transliterated them into written. This is an example, the first one there, the Thalam tunnel inscription on the bearing through of the tunnel by King Hezekiah. The bottom beginning is the old squarish character that we know of Hebrew, which came into use around 400 BCE. Before that, the only written languages available to him were the Sumerian, Babylonian, cuneiform, and here again you have the English, the transliteration, and the hieroglyphics on top, the English, the transliteration, and the cuneiform on the bottom. The cuneiform dates from about 5000 BCE and the Egyptian hieroglyphic from about 3200. Intimate knowledge of another language is necessary if you're to catch the nuances, the puns, the play on words, the allusions inherent in the roots of the words. When a Jehovah-worshipping king of Israel names his sons with the letters B-A-A-L in their names, you realize how integrated into the common life and religion was the worship of the local gods, the Baals. In like fashion, the saint in St. George, St. Louis, San Gabriel, San Francisco, our calendar, our holidays, all these things reflect the influence of the Catholic religion in our life and language. Remember that every translation is the exegesis of the translators as they strive to determine, if possible, what the author meant as well as what is written. You and I, when we study Scripture, are doing exactly the same, but we work in only one language, our own, as we turn verbal symbols into meaning. The results will vary with our intelligence, our education, and our experience in life as well as in translating. However, I believe all studies should start with the literal text. What does the text actually say? Is it really literal or figurative or symbolic? I know almost no Hebrew or Greek, have only a smattering of Latin and German, so my exegesis, meaning it's a Greek word for meaning to translate or to guide out, is in translation. I depend on the scholars for the equivalency of words and meanings, for explanation of the poems and the play on words. The title of my paper is The Garden in Eden. In the study I've used mainly six translations of Genesis, three Christian, the King James, the Smith Goodspeed, and the Luther, and three Jewish, the Tanakh, the New Jerusalem Bible, David Rosenberg's translation in the Book of Jay, and the Rabbi Elizabeth Sarah translation in exegesis in the book Women's Voices. After we leave the familiar ground six-day creation of slave creation, with man given domination over everything on earth, in Genesis 1:1 to 2:3, we bump into a much older, almost entirely different story of creation in Genesis 2:4. It begins with God apparently creating most everything in the day. God had created the plants, the seeds, that is, and herbs, but none were growing yet for two reasons. One, there was no rain, though God had caused a mist or a flood or a flow, these are different words from different translations, to water the surface or face of the ground. And two, there was no one to till the ground, to dress it, and to keep it. In other words, there was no gardener. So God took Adama, and please excuse my emphasis and pronunciation, I'll probably make him cringe, which is a female noun, soil, earth, or dust, and he took a female A-H ending off of it and created Adam, or rather the Adam, an earthling, a man, and breathed into it, him, there's no it in Hebrew, the breath of life, and made it a living soul. This is one of the several play on words to be found in the J account of Genesis. In English, man can be either male, singular, and specific, or genderless, plural, and nonspecific. We can only guess which by the context. In German, the word is Mensch, a human. Hebrew has no neuter gender. Most words are nouns and pronouns are masculine, which also complicates the translation. This Adam, a man, was first created and then made into a human being, a creature of flesh, by receiving the breath, the ruach, of life into his nostrils. Since it's not good for the Adam to be alone, and there's no real proper name Adam till later, God seeks to find a helpmeet to keep him company. The old English meet denoted independent equality and suitability, and apparently the two Hebrew terms to describe this also indicate this same thing, independence and equality. All the beasts and the birds were brought to him for naming, but none among them, there was still no adequate partner found for the man. You should note the social rather than the sexual concern here. After the creation of the woman, the man reverses this emphasis and also assumes dominance in his flesh of my flesh, bone of my bone poems. God cast a slumber on the Adam, not an ordinary sleep, but more anesthetic like Abram's vision fell asleep, and he removed a T-Z-I-L-A. It's a female noun meaning side or rib. In the Old Testament, its use seems to be usually out of side, the sides of the ark, Exodus 26 to 28, the sides of the cedar paneled temple walls in 1 Kings 6:15, the sides or slope of the hill in 2 Samuel. I want you to imagine an oval and stick figure, front view, with a line running directly down the middle, and I'll ask you, which side did God use to craft a woman to make a isha out of an ish? And here again, ish, or man, put a female ending on it and make the woman. In other words, you have made a woman out of a man, which turns biology on its head. Here's another play on words. This time it's possible in English as well as Hebrew. By using a side, God fulfilled the need for an equal partner. A second creation from dust would have left Eve, left the woman, eternally number two. This may be wrong, but the logic appeals to me. Man's historic and often barbarous domination of women is bad enough with the presently accepted view. In Genesis 1:27, God, and this is a plural, masculine noun, incidentally, had created two sexes, a male and female. Our English male-female is apparently not equivalent to the Zachar-Nekivah, is that approximately? Which Rabbi Sarah delicately says, quote, are symmetrical terms denoting anatomical differentiation for reproduction. That would be a bit too earthy to translate publicly. God planted a garden eastward in Eden and made to grow beautiful and fruit-bearing trees there. And in the middle, he planted two unusual trees. One, the tree of the knowledge of good and bad, or righteous and evil, if you prefer religious terms. And two, the tree of immortal life. I'll skip the location of Eden. It's confusing. Now we have the man and woman in the garden, smooth-skinned, or naked, and unashamed. Enter the talking snake. Serpent is Latin, snake is Old English. Both mean the same. The snake was a little smoothie. He was smooth-tongued. More than any beast which God had made. This is another play on words. I'm sorry, I don't have a slide to put on. The snake was, and there's a glottal stop, A-R-U-M. Harun? Can you get the gargle at the beginning?
Only arrows.
Okay. Meaning smooth tongue, or subtle, or shrewd, or cunning. And the people were mean, smooth-skinned, or naked. Unlike the beasts and the birds, they had no covering of hair, fur, scales, or feathers. The snake queries the woman about what God had said they could eat in the garden, and she recites the warning previously given by God to the man regarding the tree of the knowledge of good and bad. The woman then amplifies it. Neither shall you touch it, lest you die. Actually, in Hebrew, this is another play on words. The day you touch it, death touches you. In other words, you become mortal. The tree is not a deadly poison. The snake's disparaging, "Ye shall not surely die," or as Tyndale put it, "Tush, ye shall not die," is coupled with a revelation that upon eating, their eyes would be opened, and they would become like the gods, the heavenly beings, knowing good and bad. The woman, interestingly enough, realized that the fruit was one, good for eating, good for food, pleasant, a lovely delight to the eyes. Three, a desirable as a source of wisdom, lively to the mind. So she eats, gives some to the man, he eats also. Strangely, the immediate change was to acquire a sense of shame, realizing that they were smooth-skinned. So they took fig leaves and made some sort of covering. You take your choice, aprons, girdles, breeches, loincloths, and so forth. Translators' guesses always equate genital exposure with naked. And they hid. They heard the voice of God walking in the windy, ruach time of the day, which is the evening, calling to them. The obvious answer to God's query about how did they know they were naked produced the blame-shifting responses. The man, the wimp, says, "The woman whom you gave to be with me, she gave it to me." Blaming both God and the woman. The woman simply stated, "The smooth-tongued snake gave it to me, I ate." At this point, three obviously ancient poems are inserted into the prose narrative. The first is a curious curse on the snake. Crawl on his belly, eat, taste dust, endure eternal enmity with women, though the head bruising will probably be done by her male descendants. I have a note. This poem is omitted in the original Pearl of Great Price Book of Moses. Subsequent ones are stuck back in. The second and third poems are not so much curses as they are a statement of the hardships that the two have brought by becoming mortal. The woman will in pain bring forth many children. Groans that spread into groans. Actually, the last of the poem in Hebrew seems to say, you will get pregnant a lot, for you will like girls and want to be impregnated. The King James and other Bibles euphemistically blur the sexual connotations with your desire, your urge, your longing shall be for your husband, your mom. One translator renders it thus: to your man's body your belly will rise, for he will be eager above you. It is odd that the King James in mid-sentence switches to the sexual theme, from the sexual theme to one of patriarchal dominance. So much for ruling over women. The ground is cursed for the man's sake. He will really have to sweat to wrest his living from the soil, and at death he will return to the dust from which he came. At this point, the gentle, compassionate, and paternal God makes clothing for them out of wild animal skins and clothes them. I get the picture of a father dressing his small children before they go outdoors into school. God here confirms the truth of what the snake told the woman, for their eyes were open, they had fallen open, and they, like her gods, knew good and bad. The possibility then existed that they might reach out, take from the second tree of life, and become immortal. To forestall this, God banishes them from the garden and posts the cherubims, the winged sphinxes with the fiery ever-whirling sword, to block the path back. They are not driven out for disobedience or transgression. They were expelled because of the possibility that they might take from the second tree. Note, our DMC 20 says that Adam was tempted, partook, and was driven out. Eve is not even mentioned. In chapter 4, Adam and Eve have become proper names, although there was an interruption in the man-woman narrative in Genesis 2:8-9, where the Ish, the man, is called Adam, probably a later insertion. Subsequent LDS scriptures informed us that Adam and Eve rejoiced in their decision, and the fall is an upward progression. I didn't get to color the sections, but if you look carefully, you can see that Eve rejoiced and so forth. The story is actually one of choice, of the exercise of agency, and was not the source of all subsequent human ills, with one half the population dragging on the other half. It also was not a sexual sin, as the clergy, especially from St. Augustine on, have insinuated, making everyone's existence, since all arrive here through childbirth, the consequence of coitus, a sin smeared one, the original sin, needing the clergy or the church for assistance and also control for a remedy. Note Eve's exclamation at Cain's birth, "I have gained a man and a male child from the Lord." Actually, then the translators feel it's an exaltation, almost a boast. "I have created a man like Yahweh did," as Yahweh has. The jubilant tone, despite the agony of childbirth, is very obvious. Her second son was Abel. Abel became a sheepherder, Cain a sodbuster, and the feud began. But that's another story, and not in Eden.
It is my task today to respond to Dr. Wallace's Modern Mormon Commentary on Adam and Eve in the Garden. Before I begin, however, I must first respond to his introduction, which outlines some of the textual problems of the Hebrew Scriptures and opts for the Graf-Wellhausen hypothesis as a solution to those problems. Normally, the Orthodox Jews' response to the fact that Moses didn't write the Pentateuch is, "You're absolutely right. The Pentateuch was written by Moses' cousin, whose name was also Moses." So, I must further ask you to bear in mind that an analysis of the Pentateuch, the first five books of the Bible, is best handled separately from other biblical texts, such as the King David story problems. Except where those texts serve as a commentary on the Pentateuch. Only the Pentateuch is traditionally ascribed to Moses. The Pentateuch is the central element of the Hebrew Bible. It purports to contain the fastidiously transmitted story of God's revelation to Israel, the Exodus, the giving of the law, and the beginning of the fulfilling of the covenant of the land. It is no mere history. Within the Pentateuch, Genesis has a special status. It is not directly a part of the ministry of Moses. It is rather a history of the world and of the family which gave rise to Israel, God's chosen people. As such, it is Mosaical without being a part of the revelation at Sinai. Indeed, the revelation at Sinai unfolded over the years as Moses composed the Torah and learned to judge Israel. The narrative itself tells us that Yitro, Moses' father-in-law, suggestions were incorporated into the way the people handled problems, and that God approved the suggestions of others, such as his approval of the female inheritance when the question was brought up by Zelophehad's daughters. The ongoing nature of this revelation extended through the ages, as is illustrated by the Talmudic passage when Moses visits Rabbi Akiva's academy in a dream and is amazed to see the nuances of the Torah of which he was unaware. When German scholars in the 19th century systematically began to challenge the historicity of the Bible, they attacked the unity of the Pentateuch. According to their hypothesis and its more modern critical offspring, the existence of similar stories, such as Abraham passing Sarah off as his sister with both Pharaoh and Abimelech, and Isaac doing the same for Rebekah with Abimelech, is best explained by assuming the editor of the biblical text was including variant versions of the same story. Scholars look for key words, philological evidence of origin, and comparison with other Near Eastern texts. This is a serious, careful approach to the biblical text, sometimes known as the higher criticism. It should not be confused with the fantastic speculations of Harold Bloom, a literary critic with no training in biblical textual analysis or even Hebrew. Within the Pentateuch, one may be able to separate Genesis, or at least that part of it prior to Abraham, from the four books of Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. But this presents a special problem for Christians. Christianity is based on the premise that Adam and Eve sinned, and that an overwhelming sacrifice of the Son of God, even God himself, was necessary to redeem mankind from the consequences of that sin. Mormonism has the additional problem in that it has not only one, but three authoritative texts of the creation: the Bible, the Book of Moses, and the Book of Abraham. Abraham and Moses present only minor deviations from the received text, as does the inspired version of the Bible. If Joseph Smith were a prophet, would he not have seen the truth of Graf Wellhausen? Even more to the point, if the patriarchs, the redemption from Egypt, and the explicit giving of the law did not occur, make no mistake that all are brought into doubt by modern criticism, then Israel was not passed over because of the blood of the Passover lamb, and Christians no longer can accept the Hebrew scriptures as prefiguring the death of the Lamb of God. This may present no difficulty for believing non-believers who prefer their God or Savior to have no real purpose besides being warm and cuddly, but it presents difficulties for those who want to hold on to a God acting in history, a Redeemer. How then are believers to confront the textual difficulties of the Pentateuch in a rigorous scholarly manner? As most textual problems were well known in Talmudic and medieval times, it can be posited that modern criticism is not the only solution, or even the preferable solution, to the problems of the Pentateuch. And I might say that we did not burn or remove Ibn Ezra from his position as being one of our great teachers in Israel because he pointed out the very problems that are articulated. Ibn Ezra's commentary stands in every one of the Mikraot Gedolot, those who great commentaries on the Pentateuch, where you have all of the great rabbis. He's right there on the other side of the page from Rashi. So this is well known, these problems. I would like to think through with you an approach to the text that is rooted in Jewish tradition, and which I find makes a great deal of historic and literary sense. Of course, I cannot disprove modern criticism. I can only suggest that its theoretical adequacy should be measured against other ways of looking at the text before personal judgments are made. Even a passing reading of Genesis and the four books of Moses' ministry reveals a very complex cultural and religious world, a world that is in no way completely intelligible from the text alone. For 3,000 years, Jewish exegetes have referred to the oral law or tradition in order to understand the written text. This oral tradition supplies the context for the text, which makes it intelligible. The tradition supplies the vowels, which so troubled Dr. Wallace in his search for meaning. In a Semitic language, the vowels are more often associated with nuance than basic meaning. In very few places is there a question of total meaning dependent on vowels. Context in ancient Hebrew, as in modern Hebrew, supplies intelligibility. And in fact, modern Hebrew newspapers are printed without vowels. Vowels are often unnecessary, even in non-Semitic languages, just as CT can mean cat or cut or cot. The sentence TH, DG, CHSD, TH, CT is easily decipherable. The dog chased the cat. We wouldn't say the dad chugged the cot. I mean, you would see this, and you see it. It's clear. And the Hebrew is even easier to read. This is not to dismiss the importance of nuance in vowel placement, but these were supplied with remarkable accuracy by the schools of Ben Asher and Ben Naphtali and the later Ben Uziel, who passed the tradition of vowel placements down from father to son. And I would like to say that it's very important for us to note that when we are asked oftentimes by Christians, do you believe in the Bible? Do you believe it's true? Sometimes we say to them, you believe in every word of the Bible. We believe in the truthfulness of every letter of the Bible. And this is very important, because in our tradition there are certain things which describe the Bible itself, the Pentateuch itself, as merely one long version of the name of God, one long way in which one can glorify God. But this is not a mystical way of approaching the text, and we separate that quite clearly from the more rational scholarly ways. The oral tradition both asks questions and supplies answers. For example, Rashi, in his 11th century commentary on Genesis, asks, why does a book of law begin with the creation instead of the first commandment in Exodus 12:2? The answer is to protect the Jews from the charge of theft when they inherit the promised land. Because God made all the earth, he has the right to give a part of it to whomever he chooses. As strange as Rashi's answer might seem to modern scholars, it is rooted in tradition. How carefully that tradition was guarded and how accurately it was passed on is seen in Genesis Rabbah, a collection of homiletic stories and glosses, Midrashim, on Genesis, probably collected about the 5th century of the Common Era. The Midrash on Genesis 36:7 explains that Ham's son Canaan is cursed by Noah instead of Ham. And then we know that it was Ham who dishonored his father Noah. Why did this happen? Because Ham had already been blessed, and only his son, therefore, could be cursed. The Midrashim also make Canaan an active participant in the sin. This explanation is identical to the one found in the Genesis Florilegium, column 2 of the Dead Sea Scrolls, written several hundred years earlier. This is how carefully the tradition has been transmitted. Recently, study of the written text has revealed something the tradition hinted at: markers or codes which facilitate correct transmission. Such codes have been found in certain Greek and Latin works and seem to have been regularly employed in the ancient world. Some see the spelling out of names of the plants in the Holy Land in the Genesis garden text as proof of the hand of God in its writing. Without recourse to such a faith statement, anyone can see that Torah codes involving counting letters and markers would help preserve the text and influence its form. So if you count so many letters and mark a letter and so many letters and mark a letter, it spells words. And this was a way to make sure that it doesn't work with the Samaritan text. It only works with the Masoretic text, because the Samaritan text, we know, even though it comes from what we call the same recension as the Masoretic text, it was theologically changed to make, you know, Mount Gerizim, among other things, the holy place, and that throws the whole book off. The oral tradition lays great emphasis on the divine names used in the Pentateuch, not unlike modern scholars with their J&E texts, by the way. It teaches that names are not random, but vehicles of meaning. The tetragrammaton, Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh, YHWH, indicates God's attribute of mercy, while Elohim, which is also a term used for judges, indicates the attribute of justice. Rashi wrote that if only the Elohim of Genesis 1 had been revealed, the wayward, unjust world would have been destroyed. Therefore, Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh, mercy, was introduced in Genesis 2. I find that following the divine names has more predictive value in understanding the Pentateuch than modern criticism. And now, as a person trained in science, one of the things we deal with in science is predictability. If I come up with a theory that only says what has already happened, it doesn't mean I have to be able to say an event will happen if certain conditions are met. Now, the Graf Wellhausen theory of the text really is an ex post facto thing. I go through and say, here's this, here's that, I'll cut this out, put it here, it belongs there. But a text which has predictability, some theory which has predictability, to tell you that this text will have a certain kind of form, to me has some impressive credentials. It doesn't necessarily mean it's true, of course, but it does have impressive credentials. For example, in the story of the binding of Isaac, Genesis 22:1-13, Elohim tests Abraham, telling him to sacrifice Isaac. But an angel of the tetragrammaton, Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh, stops the sacrifice. So here we have 13 verses in which we have a JT. Exodus 6:3, God tells Moses that Abraham had not known him as Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh, but as Kel Shaddai, that is, God's power. This is a confusing passage, because God in Genesis is usually referred to by the tetragrammaton. This must be a very foolish editor. Do you see, he's gone through this whole text of Genesis with all of this, the Lord said, which is what it's translated in English, and then all of a sudden, the Lord never appeared to Abraham. I mean, this is bad editing. It's kind of like my spelling, I'm sure. Okay. This is a confusing passage because Genesis usually refers to God as the tetragrammaton. Why would an editor allow this inconsistency? That is, unless the reader and Moses and the people of Israel can understand that Abraham did not know God's redemptive power, the redemptive power that Israel was about to experience in the Exodus. This, of course, is the subject of the rest of Exodus 6. The doctrine of divine names yields a most cogent solution to the problem of Exodus 3:13-14, when Moses asked God, "Who shall I say sent me?" Clearly, Moses knew the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. God answers with a play on the name, the tetragrammaton, the Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh, "I will be that I will be." The question seems to be, in the traditional reading of the text, is justice sending me, justice which might destroy the wayward people in the desert, or is mercy sending me, mercy which will forgive and preserve them? By playing on the name of mercy, God answers that he will redeem them, but not fully. By not fully saying Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh, we can understand that Israel may pay a price for the redemption.
If the oral tradition does reflect the context, the religio-intellectual milieu of the composition of the Pentateuch, then textual problems can only be solved by understanding that tradition. The oral tradition reveals a literary form, while modern criticism produces more and more text fragments which confuse the narrative. Now on to the Garden of Eden. As Genesis is a preface to the ministry of Moses, and from the text itself, not necessarily revealed in the same way as the law, it has given rise to many interpretive efforts, which reach back millennia. I will present to you a few which reflect on Dr. Wallace's view of the Adam and Eve story. Man, Adam, the dirt man, was created male and female, that is, androgynous. Let us make man does not indicate a plurality of gods, but rather teaches us the necessity of humility. For even God consulted with the heavenly host before making man. Man is created in God's likeness. This likeness means a similarity in form and deed. The first creation, in Genesis 1, was not physical, but in potentia. The potential was realized in Genesis 2. These are the generations. Earthly man received heavenly matter when God breathed a soul into him. This gave him the divine attribute of speech. The woman was made a helper opposite him. Keneged means opposed. She would help if he did right and oppose if he did wrong. She, unlike all beings, was suited to him because she had a soul and the power of speech. The serpent did not speak, but rather an angel spoke through him, as in the case of Balaam's ass. He phrased the question, "Shall you not eat of any of the trees?" She answered that they could eat, but not of the tree in the midst of the garden, and that they shall not touch it. She added the prohibition on touching to "gods thou shalt not eat." The serpent touched the tree and did not die. The woman then touched and ate. She sinned because she added to God's commandment and thus could be tricked. She then gave the man the fruit and he ate, not asking its source. She was punished for eating and misleading the man. He was punished for relying on her. The serpent became the loathsome serpent of the world outside the garden. The woman was cursed with pain in childbirth. Both she and the man were cursed with the pain of child rearing. I disagree with Dr. Wallace's reading of the text. Eve does not boast that she has made a child, but merely exclaims, "I have acquired a man from or by the Tetragrammaton." She says, "Kaniti ish et Hashem." In the same way, I would come home to my wife and I'd say, "Kaniti mechonit et Larry Miller." I acquired a car from Larry Miller. But because the Tetragrammaton is used, et Tetragrammaton, YHWH, she is saying that I acquired a man-child in this great pain of birth through the mercy of God. God mercifully preserved her in pain, if we follow the traditional use of the names of God. The meaning of the Garden of Eden story is fully realized through the oral tradition. It is not a children's story, but a multifaceted depiction of man and woman together in the world. As Dr. Wallace's commentary indicates, the text is a rich source for insights. Genesis is, however, more than just venerable tales. Through the efforts of Moses, the prophets, and the rabbis, it became the proper beginning of God's revelation to Israel. Thank you.
We have a few minutes left for questions, and I'll invite you to ask questions. Would you mind coming up and speaking into the mic?
For Dr. Walton, what is the your feeling of the creation? Do you believe in creationism? I mean, is it a period of time? Is it evolutionary? You have the history of science.
Maybe you could each respond to that.
Anyone who has studied anatomy, embryology, biology, knows that there has been an evolutionary process going on. All life on Earth has, you can see the connections as you study zoology, comparative vertebrate anatomy, and embryology. All mammalian life is based on the same blueprint. And we have many residuals in us as humans that more primitive forms utilize and we have abandoned. The stories we have here are thousands of years old. And the Jewish people have had, 3,000, 4,000 years to speculate on it, so they've done a pretty good job. In fact, their Six Lion Legends of the Jews is a fascinating book, and I like very much the tale of Lilith. I didn't get into Adam's first wife. But I have tried to point out what Dr. Walton does, and this is to read into the text his own religious meaning and background. Take the text simply. What does it say? Don't say, well, this is because his... don't add details. It says the snake's taught. Don't make up Satan and have it an angel talking through the snake and all of this kind of thing. This is what the story says. This is our basic religious mythology, and I know of no better substitute for it. But the lessons, there are many things to be learned, but we have been subjected, it seems to me, to much misinterpretation, deliberate misinterpretation, maybe well-intentioned misinterpretation, into thinking that this choice on the part of Adam and Eve was a sin, quote unquote. Something terrible for which they, all mankind, had to be punished. I think that's pure baloney. I think that's been read into the story illegitimately, as well as all the thousands of other details that you can read into the thing and make it what you want. I don't leave you with any good answers. Each of you is going to have to do your own interpretation. Put in your own details to make sense out of it. Your own exegesis. And it was to stimulate this kind of thinking and wondering about this basic book. The Jewish people are the people of the book. We're in the Christian era and they're the people of the book. I hope Mormons don't become the people of the book with their Book of Mormon, surely. But we have all of these sources available to us and can look forward to new and better interpretations and relations. My exegesis on the Garden of Eden points out a much better picture for women than it does for the man, the Adam. And I think that the treatment of women by men has been atrocious, and that basing it on this as a religious basis and say God made it this way and that's why it's right has been used to justify slavery and every other kind of evil in this world. And I think that the woman being created equal, opposite, the word in Hebrew is opposite, negative. Equal but opposite, in other words, a partner, not a subservient thing. I'm probably talking too much, but I'll turn over the mic.
I will address your question in just one second. Let me first say to Dr. Wallace, number one, I believe that this text has meaning because it comes out of a tradition. If you in fact believe in a redacteur, if you in fact believe that some woman at the time of Solomon wrote something in this, the Jewish tradition is crucial to understanding what in the heck they're trying to communicate. That was what I said. I did not say that you should take any kind of thing out of the sky and use it, number one. So this book is a Jewish book. It was produced by a Jewish tradition, and I'm trying to say that if you want to understand it, you can go listen to Graf Wellhausen, er hat Hochdeutsch gesprochen, und er hat in periodic sentences geschrieben, and all of this stuff. So what? What does he know? Because this text is in itself incomplete. For example, it says, when you get divorced, you'll get a bill of divorcement. But it doesn't tell you how to write a bill of divorcement. But we have a tradition, and if we go to Elephantine, which was in the 7th century before the Common Era, we have such documents. Do you see? I'm telling you that this book is much more complicated than somebody who wants to sit down with Hebrew and work through. Number one. So I'm not saying I should impose a tradition on it. I was challenging you to understand that this is a literary product. Everyone understands that. Number one. Number two, there were certain thoughts in the minds of the people who produced this work. One of them is that Elohim means something different than Yahweh. Do you see? That's what, and I think that I made that case quite strongly. Okay, that's the thing. So, whatever scientific study of the Bible is, I will tell you it has the same problem as science. Now, I'm a great advocate of science. I do not believe we should teach creationism in the schools. Okay, for various reasons. Science, however, is in no way true. When people come to me, I just finished some articles for the Encyclopedia of the Scientific Revolution. People come to me and say, Mike, do you believe that science... Do you ever read science fiction? I say, no, to me, all science is fiction. And what do you mean by that? I say, science is a series of rules of evidence of how we evaluate data and how we manipulate data. The atom of Dalton is different than the atom of Bohr, which is different than the atom we have today. The word is the same, but the concept is different, and because we have to have different terms to manipulate to achieve things that we want to achieve in science. But science is proximal. It's right here by you. Science long ago gave up metaphysics. We say we're only going to deal with things which we can weigh and measure, as it were. And we're going to deal with certain things. Is it predictable? Can I make a prediction? And then there's another fuzzier term. Is it useful? Can I send a rocket to the moon? But what that has to do with truth, I don't know. And I will give you an example. We create mathematical equations all the time, which we believe and somehow describe reality. But I would like to challenge you to tell me exactly how you would prove that mathematics is descriptive of reality. That is a faith statement. That is an a priori assumption, which comes from the 16th century. It's a very important part of modern science, but you can't prove it. And how do you prove that the simplest explanation is the true explanation, Occam's razor? We do that for elegance, for usefulness' sake. But how do we know that a more complicated explanation isn't actually descriptive of reality? We don't. So science is a way of understanding the natural world, which uses rules, which produces very, very important results for us. Whether it's true, how would I know if it's true? I mean, was Dalton true and Bohr more true? Do you say, I don't know. I say science is science. I'm content with science. And that's why I don't believe we should teach creationism and things in the schools. Because science is something, Herr Julius Wellhausen, we would say, science is something an und für sich. It is something in and of itself. And it should be treated as that. Now, does it relate to religion? Perhaps. Perhaps it doesn't. Perhaps we have so limited the universe of discourse of science that it no longer has any kind of relationship to religion. It did at one time in the period in which I study. I just finished an article which would be published in a book called The Chemists and Genesis, which deals with Paracelsus and Oswald Krull and Robert Flood and John Baptiste van Helmont and Robert Boyle, and their use of the Genesis text. Now, so they also did commentaries. That's that. So, do I believe in creationism? Rashi said that This is not a book of science, Genesis. This is a book to teach us that God created the world and that we shouldn't draw scientific inferences from it. That's what Rashi said. There are other rabbis who said something different. Rabbi Avadya Svarno, about whom I made a presentation at Stanford a couple of years ago, Svarno died in 1550. He used Aristotelian chemistry and physics to explain parts of the text of Genesis. So this is entirely possible to do. So I don't know. But I would like to say that science works well in science. It may be less useful in literary analysis. And that is exactly what Graf Wellhausen is a philological study of the Bible in the same way. And science is modeled in many ways, if you read Mertz's history of thought, intellectual history of the 19th century, you'll see that German philology was an important pattern for the development of science and science education. And we still use that pattern. And so, you know, I was trained in it. I was asked to write for the Anchor Bible Dictionary, and out of religious reasons, I turned it down. But when I write something, it has to have scholarly validity. If the Akedah didn't have Elohim and the Tetragrammaton, then my theory would fall. Do you understand? Whether I believe it to be true or not. That's what I'm saying. We have to be scientific about this, and we have to have evidence that has meaning. And now, I'll give you another one. You wanted something? Avimelech. What does Avimelech mean? Father King. It is a title. There is no inherent inconsistency in Abraham dealing with Avimelech and his son Yitzhak dealing with Avimelech. Because it's a title. It isn't a proper noun necessarily. It could be. But, I mean, there are ways of looking at the text. But once you pick a way, and when we talk about we believe in every letter, we have picked no way. I've got Svarno, I've got Rashi, I've got Ibn Ezra. We have many ways of looking at the text. That's what I'm saying. Find something that's rational.
Our time is now up. Thank you very much, Dr. Wallace. Dr. Walton.
Hey, thank you.